This winter, and the last one under daylight saving time. I would like to remind those of you who have not yet paid a visit to the desk on your left as you came in that you'll have a nice opportunity on the way out should you wish to join the organization. Those of you who are a little bit familiar with the cost of tickets for the new basketball team will realize what a bargain we have here. At $25 for a family membership, $15 for a single membership, and $5 for students. And this is tax deductible, unlike the basketball tickets. You may have noticed that one of Dr. Bates' books is also by the entranceway for sale, and Dr. Bates has consented to sign books after his talk, should anybody wish to purchase one and have it autographed. Next week, you may be aware that Dr. Maria Clavé, who for some time has been head of the computer science department at UBC and is now a vice president, is going to talk to us about is edutainment an oxymoron? She's in, as many of you know, one of the experts on making computer games really educational, and she's a very entertaining and good lecturer. I'm sure many of you will want to come. Our speaker this evening, for those of you who don't know me, I'm John Madden. I'm president of the Vancouver Institute. Our speaker this evening, Dr. David Bates, was educated at two well-known red brick universities in England, London and Cambridge. He's a fellow of the Royal College of Physicians in London, Canada, and of course in the U.S. it's not the Royal College, but it's the American College of Physicians. Shortly after the war, he spent some time in the Royal Army Medical Corps in India, Japan and Malaysia. And after further studies, found himself at St. Bartholomew's Hospital from 53 to 56, after which he came to Canada, first to McGill for 16 years, and subsequently to UBC as Dean of Medicine from 1972 to 77, and stayed on, I guess for the whole time, he was a professor of medicine and physiology. He has a long list of honors, which I won't go through. I'm probably picking all the wrong ones, but I'll pick a couple that kind of caught my eye. He won a special citation from the Canadian Meteorological Society for his book, Citizen's Guide to Air Pollution, in 1973. He won something called the Trudeau Gold Medal, but it's from the American Thoracic Society in 1993, so I suspect it doesn't have much to do with politics.
No.
He has been, again, a long list of his experience in professional and public service. I'll list a few. Chairman of the Advisory Panel on Aviation for the Defense Research Board. Chairman of the Royal Commission on Uranium Mining in BC. A member of the Board of Environmental Studies and Toxicology of the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. A member of the Advisory Committee on Air Quality for the GVRD, a position he still is active and holding. He's been a visiting professor at Harvard, North Carolina, Otago, California, John Hopkins, Wisconsin, Washington, Dalhousie, Melbourne, and McGill. Over 230 scientific papers and 3 books. A short volume of poetry, privately printed. That's, I think, a fourth book. Dr. Bates' topic for this evening is Growth Without Air Pollution, Vancouver and Elsewhere. Will you please welcome Dr. David Bates. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Right. We do the lights from here?
I'm sorry?
We do the lights from here, or does the projections do them?
Peter, do we do the lights from here?
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. It's nice to be back. I was actually the first speaker in this auditorium because I arrived just as this building was finished And they hadn't yet quite finished the dean's office upstairs when I was in here to welcome the incoming medical class. That seems an age ago. I'm going to try and answer four questions. Do we have a significant air pollution problem? If so, how has this come about? What steps have we taken so far to try and reduce air pollution? And what will we have to do in the future if we're going to prevent degradation of the air in the airshed? I'm not going to deal with those questions sequentially. I'm going to move backwards and forwards. I'm going to look at Vancouver in relation to problems elsewhere to give you a perspective on where we stand. But by the end of 50 minutes, you should have an idea of the answers to those four questions. Could I have the first slide? I think we have I have a thing here. Let me see if I can get the first slide on. That's actually the second slide. Yes. Now, lights here. For these, I'm going to reduce the lights because they're going to be photographs of air pollution. This is a quotation from Act Two of the Cocktail Party, which I've always liked. Edward, who's in some trouble, says, "And since then I've realized that mine is a very unusual case." And Riley, who is really a psychiatrist, says, "All cases are unique and very similar to others." And that is really exactly our present case. And I'm going to stress both the things that are unique and the things that we share with pretty well everybody else. This is a remarkable satellite photograph of where we are. They're given to me by Rick Bennett of BC Environment. And you're familiar with it, obviously. We're out here. This is Stanley Park. These are the ferry terminal and Roberts Bank. This is the Fraser River bringing down its mud. And these are mountains, of course, and south, which you can't see, also mountains. The thing is that the generation of the pollutants is here, more or less, entirely. And the wind direction, as I'm going to show you, is more or less into the Fraser Valley on most days in the summer. If you drive down West 8th, as I do, this happened to be a day in September a couple of years ago, you can see it's a very clear day. This is the school for the deaf. Very clear day. I can see the British properties here. There's absolutely no mist of any sort. And here's Stanley Park. And notice behind Stanley Park, you can see something. And if you swing the camera around a little bit more, you can see that whatever that was is behind the city of Vancouver here. And when you look right into the Fraser Valley, Simon Fraser has disappeared. Simon Fraser is here. And you can't see it. This is a common enough experience. I have photographed this a number of times, in point of fact, and it's a general observation that a day of relatively still air, you'll get this kind of phenomenon. And if you're downtown and you look out towards the mountains, you can see it close too. Mark you, you're generally in it, but you can see it quite clearly here. We share this, of course, with most other places, and this is a photograph of Calgary, taken on a winter morning in January, light snow cover, and here's exactly the same thing, and this is the result of the early morning traffic commuting into Calgary. It's all traffic generated. There's an inversion, obviously, and no mixing above this point. Now, why do these particles stay like this? I put one in Seattle because I'm going to show you some health data of Seattle, and it's exactly the same phenomenon pictured here in a Seattle magazine. Well, it's obvious that the bigger the particle, the faster it settles. And if we're talking about particles that are in the micron scale, say 10 microns, and I'm going to be talking a bit about them, the settling rate is very slow. This is centimeters per second settling, 10 to the minus 3. This means, in fact, that if you generate particles of this size, it's going to be roughly, and you put them at, say, 10 feet up, it's going to be about 12 hours before they get to ground level. If the particles are even smaller down here, the settling rate is even slower. So that if you're downwind from a city like Birmingham by 5 miles, you've got a lot of these fine particles in the area. They have not settled. The reason they have not settled is that they're very small. Now, the striking new information, which has been gained only in the last 8 years, is that these particles are damaging people. We call them PM10, meaning particles of less than 10 microns. This is the jargon for this form of particulate pollution. And the studies have consisted of taking a big area like Philadelphia or Seattle, plotting the deaths each day, excluding accidents and suicides, and measuring in several places the fine particulate pollution. And it turns out that there is a constant relationship, a constant association of the level of pollution that existed yesterday and the mortality of the next day. So that a 100 microgram cubic meter increase in this particulate pollution is associated with a 4 to 8% increase in mortality all round the year. And when I made this slide, this had been demonstrated to be true of all these places, London, England, New York City, Detroit, Philadelphia, and so on, including Santa Clara County, California, which is San Jose. Very different climate, very different sort of population, same phenomenon. Birmingham, Alabama, and I could now double this list because it's been shown also for Milan in Italy, Amsterdam in Holland, Santiago in Chile, that I'll be saying a little about, and everywhere that everybody is measuring this fine particulate pollution, the mortality relationship applies. But that isn't all. It has been shown to be aggravating asthma, and that's been shown in Seattle and in Utah, particularly good studies. The admissions to hospital with acute respiratory disease are related to the particulate pollution, and in Holland, they've done a particularly good study of normal school children, measuring their lung function. This is a test of lung function, twice a day in the schoolroom, measuring this year-round, measuring the fine particulate pollution, and showing that the lung function of normal children cycles with the PM10 level. So when the PM10 goes up, their lung function goes down. The mortality data is very impressive. This is Philadelphia. Here are the suspended particulates, actually PM10 here going up. And here is the relative risk of death, starting at 1 here and going up to 3. That's a 3% increase in risk of death. It's a linear relationship, controlling for all other factors. And when you ask, well, who's being affected? Of course, the risk, and here's the relative risk, this is 1, no increase of risk. The relative risk is increased in people over 65 compared to people under 65. You'd expect this because people over 65 are in fact closer to natural mortality. And it's particularly high risk of people with chronic lung disease. These are people with chronic lung disease with pneumonia and with cardiovascular disease. This is of very considerable interest. The risk is increased here, and these are all deaths from heart disease. So that's what's happening. And another study, I haven't time to discuss in detail, showed that, in fact, it wasn't a matter that this mortality was just taking people on a Monday who would have died on a Wednesday, a 48-hour shift type of thing, but that in cities in the States with higher PM10 levels, the expectation of survival starting at age 45, was adversely affected. So that longevity is affected in this process. Here's the Seattle data. Four Seattle hospitals, patients under the age of 65, compared to inhaled particles on the previous day. Here are the PM10 particles on the previous day. Here are the emergency visits per day. A simple monotonic relationship. So the next question is, well, where's Vancouver in relation to Seattle? And our first PM10 data reached me last week, and I can say that we're in here, in Vancouver. PM10 sometimes goes up as high as 70. That's unusual. It's mostly around 50 and 30 in here. So we fit into this as an average for our PM10. Now, you'd think that with the present state of medical knowledge, I could tell you why these particles are harmful, not only in terms of mortality, but also with asthmatics. And there is at the moment no good biological explanation of those statistics. There's a tremendous research effort going into trying to find out what's happening. These particles are small enough that they deposit deep down in the lung. They don't get stopped in the throat. Anything less than 10 microns goes right deep into the lung. But why we should be seeing these phenomena is unclear. Next question is, where do they come from? Well, the PM10, which is what we're really concerned with, the inhalable particles, in Vancouver, this is all Vancouver data, the transportation section is large here, gasoline vehicles, diesel vehicles, other mobile sources here, and some industrial sources here. This is grain handling in the docks, this bulk shipping. Well, it's minerals, but it comes in here. And this is roughly where it's coming from, and the diesel vehicles have a disproportionate share of the particles. They are, in fact, less than 10% of the total fleet, if you include all the motor cars. So this is a big share being contributed by the diesel engine. Now, I said I was going to try and give you a perspective. There are places where the diesel vehicle is not a small percentage of the total, but a very large percentage. And this is a photograph of Santiago in Chile, a city of 5 million people. And here, 80% of the fine particulate pollution is diesel generated. And that's Santiago on a less good day. And that's Santiago 30 days of the year. And almost all of that is diesel generated fine particles. And the reason is that they have an enormous fleet of diesel buses, which are very old and have often seen service elsewhere before we end up in Santiago. And as the diesel engine wears, its particle pollution increases quite dramatically after 3 years. After 5 years, even more. And the source of the particulate pollution in the wearing diesel engine is the lubricating oil. So that if you insist on running your diesel engines a very long time, you end up with a high particulate pollution from the lubricating oil of the engine. Now, some very fancy observations have been made about these fine particles, and a particularly good observation made by an atmospheric chemist at the University of Washington in Seattle. And he has a rapid response instrument which measures not PM10, but PM2.5. These are 2.5 micron particles. And he has this apparatus in a van, and he parked it on the campus of the University of Washington, together with a video camera. And at this point here, a bus passed the sampling location here. And you'll see that there was a burst of particles here, which then declined. And the video camera showed that the bus had no visible exhaust. Because particles this small, 2.5 microns, you won't really see them at all. And so that even if you were standing, or if you were standing on the curb, University of Washington, on this particular day, and a bus went past, and it had no visible emission, and if you take the liberty of breathing, you will in fact get a burst of these particles here, which you can't avoid. So that when you think of how people are being affected, the issue is that the smaller the particle, the harder it is, of course, to see, but the deeper it's deposited. And all the animal experiments tell us that the finer the particle, the smaller the particle, the more dangerous it is. So that we have every reason to be very leery of this kind of phenomenon. So we share this problem with every other city, and it's not uniquely Vancouver, because everywhere that's got transportation and anywhere that's running diesel vehicles has the same general problem to contend with. I'll come back at the very end to the solution to it. The other problem we have is more complex. And this comes about because, as I said, the general direction of the wind during summer is off the sea, over the pollution emission region in the Lower Mainland, into the Fraser Valley, where, because of the mountains on either side, it doesn't go up. It's rather like a funnel. And therefore, if you're sitting right out here, you're in the end of this funnel at Chilliwack. It took a group of us, including Tim Oak of the Department of Geography here, and myself and others, about 5 years to persuade people that we had to begin to measure the pollutants down in the Chilliwack-Abbotsford region. Nobody was enthusiastic about this, except us. Well, why is this likely to be important? Because what happens is that the oxide of nitrogen produced by all the cars reacts with oxygen fairly quickly to form NO2. And this, in the presence of hydrocarbons and sunlight particularly, forms ozone, tropospheric ozone. And this ozone at level we can breathe it is bad news. The ozone in the stratosphere, where it's being depleted, is a completely different story, and the two don't meet. So that what's happening at ground level has nothing whatever to do with what's happening in the stratosphere. Well, the moment of truth for the Lower Mainland came at 4 p.m. on September the 3rd in 1988. By that time, we had some ozone monitors going in the region, and on that afternoon, in Langley, here, ozone was recorded at 212 parts per billion. These ozone contours, the 120 parts per billion contour here, 220 here, and you can see the higher contour out towards Chilliwack here. This is 80 ppb. This was the first time anyone knew what had happened or what was happening in the Fraser Valley. And why should we bother about ozone at 212 parts per billion? It is admittedly 2.5 times the current Canadian standard of 80, but would it affect anybody? Well, last year, Dr. Mike Brower here made some observations on farm workers in the Fraser Valley working out in the field, for physical work for 10 hours, and he put ozone monitors and badges on the workers and had an ozone analyzer running in the field. And the highest ozone that he recorded during that period of harvesting was about 76 parts per billion, less than half this. And at that level of ozone, he was able, by measuring the lung function of these workers, to show that one day's work had taken about 5% off their normal lung function due to the ozone they were breathing. And we have every reason to be very chary of this, because we now know that ozone produces this effect on lung function because it has caused inflammation in the human lung. We have a whole spate of human data that I'm not going to bother you with. But when your lung function declines as a result of breathing ozone, you can show that the lung has been inflamed, and there are cells there which indicate the inflammation that's occurred. If you are more interested in agriculture and do work like Vic Runnicles here does, this is a very high level of ozone for crops. Even 120 is much too high. Even 80 here is much too high. And the current estimate of the crop loss in the Fraser Valley, the loss of production of crops from the ozone now occurring, is $6 million a year. Because some of the crops, particularly alfalfa, very simple crop, are very sensitive to ozone. And what happens is the plants don't die, they just don't grow as well, so that the productivity is reduced. Raspberries are also rather sensitive, as a matter of fact, and that's a concern at Abbotsford and around here. This isn't, of course, just a Vancouver problem. Here, this is an episode in 94. This is data from Hope, exceeding 80 ppb, the end of the Fraser Valley here. Victoria, also cycling, and Kelowna as well. And if Kelowna goes on growing, it'll soon reach the leagues of fairly high ozone pollution. In the States, a massive effort's been mounted to understand ozone. This is an episode, 1990, centered on Atlanta. And here are the ozone concentrations. This is 120 ppb here. And over the course of 2 days, they watched this enormous lake of ozone forming over a huge area, about 2,000 miles across, with ozone above 80 in almost all of it, 80 being the blue here. So this whole area was above the Canadian maximum for ozone. This has come about because there's the many sources of oxides of nitrogen, particularly coal combustion and electric generation from coal, but many other sources, and the trees around Atlanta provide enough hydrocarbons that as the oxides of nitrogen drift in, the hydrocarbons from the trees are mingled with them, and in the presence of the strong sunlight, which you get in this part of the States, ozone is very quickly formed. So you can imagine the population that's exposed here. I mean, this isn't one or two people. This is millions of people. And in this year, 1990, 86 million Americans were in areas which had exceeded the US standard of 120 ppb for an hour. Some of the best ozone data has come from southern Ontario. There's Toronto here, Hamilton, Buffalo, Cleveland here, and Detroit. And this whole area of southern Ontario receives a lot of the pollutants from the Midwest of the States, oxides of nitrogen here. And this is transformed into ozone. And this part of Ontario is very vulnerable to that form of pollution. Here's data, and you can handle these enormous banks of information now. 168 hospitals in southern Ontario studied for 6 years, and the ozone being measured at 25 locations in southern Ontario. And here are the daily respiratory admissions to those hospitals. And here's the daily maximum one-hour ozone level, lagged 1 day, as the day before, in ppb. And it is a monotonic relationship. So that you're just putting people into hospital, these are hospital admissions, not visits, in relation to the ozone. I could spend a lot of time talking about southern Ontario, but I just wanted to show you, I said respiratory admissions, well, who are they? Well, asthma here, the particular age group affected are asthmatics between 35 and 64 years of age, but probably because they're active outdoors here. And these three stars mean this is highly significant association of the hospital admissions for the region with the ozone level. Chronic lung disease affected in older people here, but look at this. Children 0 to 1, infections as a cause of respiratory admissions, this is highly significant. Indeed, from this data, they've calculated that 25% of the hospital admissions of infants in southern Ontario must be attributed to the summer level of pollution. This is remarkable data, and I was part of a study which we published 2 years ago, just of Metropolitan Toronto. This is Metropolitan Toronto only, hospital admissions, and here's the strong association with ozone, also with hydrogen ion and sulfate, because in that region you have sulfuric acid being formed as well, and so you get all three of these driving hospital admission data for Toronto. You can also see asthmatics alone being affected, just as you could in the other data for Southern Ontario as a whole. I may say it's been singularly difficult to get Ontario to pay any attention whatever to that data. I do periodically get invited, and I go and review all this data and say it's high time Ontario realized what's happening, and everyone says yes, and everyone believes that in the room, and absolutely nothing happens in relation to it. So that it's been a very lethargic administration, both in Toronto and Ontario, in relation to this problem. I'm very much concerned with Los Angeles in relation to ozone. I have been for 25 years. This is Los Angeles. This is downtown Los Angeles. The international airport's about here. This is Santa Monica. And these are the typical ozone contours. These are numbers of days in which the standard, the California standard, was exceeded. On the beach in Santa Monica, only 25 days a year. But when you get in here, San Bernardino, and in this region, 125. These are high Glendora here, Azusa. These are high ozone regions. And notice they aren't close to the downtown, which is where the NOx is being emitted. That's because ozone takes some time to form. So it drifts, as it does in the Fraser Valley, and impacts the population some way out from the center. Because ozone takes a little time to form, in Los Angeles, this is Los Angeles data, there's a very unfortunate coincidence. This is the fraction of children outdoors, children aged 9 to 11. It's actually a weekend study. And here's the contour of maximal ozone concentration. This is 12 noon, and this is the afternoon. And you'll see that, unfortunately, just when children are most active outdoors, the ozone is rising and then falling. It's almost exact concordance. So that children get a high level dose of ozone simply because of the timing of the ozone formation. We've since been part of a study which has shown that in the schools in Los Angeles that are air conditioned, which is almost all of them, the ozone in the classroom is less than 10% of the ozone outdoors. So that the children get to school when the ozone's pretty low. If they stay indoors, they don't get much until it's time to go home, and then they come out at 3 p.m. into a high ozone concentration, which they inevitably come into on their way home. But this is why Los Angeles has a very complex, very efficient method of public warning to all the schools that the children must not be allowed out during recess, during any recess period. Of all the cities in the world, Los Angeles has the most efficient warning system for schools. And the children are kept in because in their air-conditioned school, they're protected from the ozone outside. They've been running a greenhouse in Los Angeles. One side of the greenhouse gets filtered air, charcoal filtered air, and the other side gets the Los Angeles atmosphere. And this is the difference between cyclamen. They have the same humidity, the same light, the same fertilizer. And if you don't think much of cyclamen, there's beans. This atmosphere in that city, almost certainly affecting people, obviously, but it's also affecting, as you can see, very dramatically the simple growth of plants. There have been many recent attempts to put into dollar figures what is happening. And in Los Angeles, we have a very precise estimate published this year for Los Angeles to pay for the adverse health effects attributable to air pollution in Los Angeles, you would have to levy a tax of 3 cents a mile on every car and 53 cents a mile on every heavy diesel vehicle. And that is to pay for the health costs. Now, one of the things that's very notable in this whole argument is that industry complains whenever they have to spend money to do anything. Immediately, there are articles saying it'll ruin the refineries to have a different sort of fuel or whatever. The costs are continuously put in front of the public of doing anything. But the hidden costs, which are these, are not discussed at all. And this is the best computed hidden cost of the current level of air pollution in Los Angeles in terms of paying for the adverse health effects. And it's punitive, 3 cents a mile on every car and 53 cents a mile on every diesel vehicle would be a punitive tax. Now, I said I was going to try and tell you what we've succeeded in doing with these two problems. Firstly, we have got good collaboration now between regional districts and different levels of government. This didn't exist at all 10 years ago. They more or less fought with each other. But now we have a regional district just being formed for the whole of the Fraser Valley, and that will meet and regularly with the Greater Vancouver Regional District, bringing the whole of the airshed problems really in front of only two bodies. The major pollution sources have been well controlled, including particularly the Burrard thermal generating plant. This, which is in Port Moody, is the biggest natural gas burning generating plant in North America. And if it was going flat out in its original form, it produced the same oxide of nitrogen as 60,000 motor cars. And it was a singularly bad place to have it because the oxides of nitrogen very easily drifted there up to Langley and into the Fraser Valley. So you couldn't have it in a worse place. There was a hearing which Tim Oak from here and I attended, and we opposed a new licensing proposal by BC Hydro that they should be allowed to run that plant in the summer to sell electricity into the United States. And we marshaled all the evidence we could and said they shouldn't be allowed to do it, and there was a great hoo-ha. And the Greater Vancouver Regional District issued them a license, but it had a lot of cautionary things in it, that they could be required to shut it down if the pollution level got too high and various things. I later discovered, nobody told me, but I discovered, that after all that, BC Hydro went to the Mitsubishi Engineering Company in Japan, which redesigned the burners under the boilers in this plant. And a very simple redesign of the burner cut the emissions in half, right there, with no cost to anyone. That reduced the emissions from 120 ppm in the stack of NOx to about 70. But even that isn't enough. And it was obvious that it had to now meet, or would have to meet in the future, the standards being applied in Los Angeles for such plants. And the only way you can do that is to put a catalytic conversion unit alongside and get rid of the NOx that way. And BC Hydro was allowed to choose. Would it move the plant completely away, or would it put in a catalytic handling process which involves ammonia and other things alongside? And they decided to do that, and they're in process of building it. And it'll cost over $250 million to do it, and the plant will then be in conformity with a Los Angeles standard for such a plant. But other pollution sources have been well controlled too, including the refineries and cement plants and various other ones, so that this is just one good example of control of a major pollution source. There's beginning public involvement, and I serve as was said, on the Air Quality Advisory Committee to GVRD. That's about 40 people, and we represent a fair cross-section of the Vancouver population, some of us with expert knowledge, but many representing SPEC and other organizations and industry, well represented, as you'd expect. So there's been public involvement in some of the decision-making, and then there's the Air Care program, which you all know about. And this is very interesting, not only from the point of view of controlling pollution, but from a sociological point of view. The air care program is designed to reduce the emissions mainly of oxides of nitrogen. It costs quite a lot to install. You pay $15 a year to trundle your car through it and have it work and be approved or failed, as the case may be. And when this was introduced, the media reaction was uniformly negative. It was, in fact, it's fair to describe it as derisory. The talk shows had people phoning in saying, I took my car to this one and it said that, and then I took it to another station and they said this, and there was a great joke. Vancouver Sun had enormous time pillorying the stupidity of government in this regard. It had nobody in the media had anything good to say about this program. And yet, when the Vancouver population was carefully surveyed last year, 80% of us said that we knew why the air care program was needed and we accepted the fact that it was necessary. So it's a very interesting example of the public really understanding what's being attempted and the media being absolutely no help at all. The Fraser Valley air pollution study done in 93, I haven't time to describe in detail, but this was a very ambitious scientific project involving aeroplanes and specialized sampling and millions of dollars, and it told us a lot about the formation of the aerosol in the Fraser Valley. And one of the things it taught us was that the hydrocarbons from the trees on the mountains on either side of the Fraser Valley are such that there's not much point in our trying to control hydrocarbons at the gas station. California has a vapor recovery program at gas stations. When you put your hose in, it sucks out the hydrocarbons, and that's an expensive program. And it wouldn't do much good here because the hydrocarbons will be supplied by the trees. And so our problem really is NOx rather than the hydrocarbons. The air care program, The air care program, this is the latest results actually up to August of 94. These are numbers of failures, actually numbers, 2,000, 4,000 up to 12,000 by year of automobile. I don't know where your car is here. My car's in here actually somewhere. You may have one out here. But even recent vehicles have a significant failure rate. And that's been one of the surprises. I mean, 1988 cars, there's quite a lot. There's 8,000 failed in this period, September 93 to August 94. This is one calendar year. And it's obvious when you look at this failure rate that many of the cars are not conforming to their manufactured specifications. Now, newer cars are very much cleaner. Look what's happened in 10 years. Hydrocarbons down by a factor of 5. Carbon monoxide down by a factor of about 100. Oxides of nitrogen by a factor of about 8 or 9 here in the design of the cars, comparable size vehicles. That is why as the vehicle fleet becomes more modern, the pollution emissions generally go down. Simply because they've been designed that way. Now, I said I was going to tell you what really has occasioned our problems. And it's very simple to do that. Between 1985 and 1992, the population went up 20%. The trips by car drivers went up over 40%. More than double. The total trips and trips per person went up and so on. And why did this happen? Well, you don't need to do a questionnaire. People with young families wanting to avoid a punitive mortgage moved out into Surrey. Both parents have to work. They have children who have to go to daycare. Two cars. They have to be taken to daycare, collected from it. This family does a lot of mileage. Not for bad reasons. I'm not being critical. It's simply what people are looking for and what the consequence is. Another thing which we should ponder is that if our society is unsafe, and you've got a 12-year-old daughter, or as I have a granddaughter, you're going to take them by car. They're not going to catch a bus home at 10:30 at night. And that increases car use and vehicle miles traveled. So that the genesis of our problem is partly the population increase, and added to that, the trips by car drivers, which have all sorts of sociological aspects, to most of which I'm really quite sympathetic. This is the most recent Lower Mainland, so this is not a problem that is going away. So what can we identify as continuing problems? Well, alternative transport modes. How have we done with that? And I would say badly, because one of the things we've not provided are safe bicycle routes into the city. No cyclist should have to cycle along a route with heavy diesel trucks. And unfortunately, our transportation people are way back in the, many years back, and they don't see that one way of getting people to use alternative modes of transport is really to make it possible. I have two medical friends who bicycle, and both have been injured in the course of cycling in the last 5 years. And this is because the city hasn't concentrated, as some European cities have, on making cycling access pleasant and safe, which means not having to use major highways or highways where there are cars parked with opening doors that they have to be very careful not to be hit by. So Vancouver has not done well here, in my view, in comparison with other cities, particularly in Europe. Reducing transport demand, van pooling. Well, an effort's been made here, thanks to the initiative of Mr. Bell, who provided the money to get this started, the Bell Foundation. And I'll show you an example of that in a moment. Some progress, but not much. Because some municipalities now require that businesses that employ more than 50 people file a transport demand management plan with the regional district. If you employ more than 50 people, you have to write a letter saying, this is what we're trying to do to avoid single driver commuting. And the very fact you have to do this means you're going to have to think about things you might do that you're not doing at the moment. We haven't gone that far. I think we should have gone that far. And, of course, the problem of locating population is very vexed and almost always comes to grief, because the sovereignty of Surrey, for instance, or Delta, or wherever, in relation to their own planning, their own population control and so on, is very hard to intrude upon. And like everywhere else, when you look at a single airshed, one of the problems in getting anything effective done is the jurisdiction of the parts. We've done nothing yet to control emissions from heavy-duty diesel vehicles. We have had great difficulty with regional airshed planning, which is only just beginning, in my view, to make sense. And another problem is that we are getting into an area of cost-benefit calculations as policy tools. And Mr. Sahota is always quoting the cost-benefit aspect of this, and much more research needs to go into this than we've done. Nevertheless, the bill in Vancouver, by current standards, is high. Not as high as Los Angeles, but nevertheless very far from being zero. You don't realize until you put it on a piece of paper what van pooling actually does. This is the Simon Fraser project, which has been one of the most successful. If you have eight users commuting an average distance, they'll contribute £7,750 of pollutants a year. If they come in one van, they contribute 41. So that there's a tremendous benefit from this, but it's difficult to organize. And if it hadn't been from the Bell Foundation, indeed the legalities of the problem, ICBC, and who's responsible for accidents, and what happens to the van at the weekends when it's not used, and who gets to drive it then, and all the rest of those problems, took almost 2 years to sort out, to make van pooling possible.
Well, there is a lot to be gained from it, and of course Seattle has gone into privileged highway lanes, you know, actually for more than two or more than three people. And this is another way of helping the commuting. BCTEL has set a fine example in Vancouver as a big corporation by making the parking of their employees punitive if they come in one at a time. If four people come in together, they get their parking free. If one person comes in, I think it's 65 a month. So that a big corporation can make the parking option punitive for a one-car driver and in that way encourage other options. Now lastly, I have to say just a word about oxide of nitrogen, which is the original pollutant and which is quite important. This was data I put together for Vancouver over a span here. I was doing a study of hospital visits at this time. And you'll see that over this quite long period, 2.5 years, there are some days when the oxide of nitrogen goes up dramatically. These are days of temperature inversion. The cars are not putting out more, it's just that there's no ventilation, and so you get a high NOx day. This is 120 ppb here. London, in December of 91, had the worst NOx air pollution episode yet recorded. This was a photograph taken during the episode. For 8 hours on two consecutive days, the oxide of nitrogen, it was December, went above 400 ppb. Here it is on a monitor working in West London. Here's running along here, 1991, and then here's the episode. Two consecutive days, and it was up to 400 ppb. That is a dangerous concentration, and they mounted a massive public campaign by every media means to tell people to stay home, particularly any asthmatics and anyone else who felt frail. And they tried to limit the people exposed to this. This was all automobile generated, and it was who's responsible for that? Well, essentially Mrs. Thatcher. Mrs. Thatcher opposed successfully Britain being forced to put catalytic things on the exhaust of its vehicles. And the common market said, very well, you can opt out. And they opted out. And so the consequence is that London has very high NOx pollution problem, far higher than Paris or anywhere else, because the British didn't want to be told by the common market they had to put on exhaust controls. The common market is getting very aggressive in Europe, and it passed a resolution which was binding on the British that they had to put tube monitors around the country. These are called Palms tubes, and you can actually wear one on a lapel, and over the course of a month, it'll record your average exposure to oxide of nitrogen. They were made to do this in 1986, and here was the result, with the highest NO2 being red, and they didn't have any of those, but the pink one here, the London area, industrial areas in the Midlands showing pink, these are higher NO2. The Highlands of Scotland, of course, virtually zero. And then they were made to do it again in 91. Same thing. And now look, London has a big red spot in the middle, and the pink areas got much bigger. And these areas have got much bigger. And even in the Highlands, the light blue has begun to extend compared to the dark blue. So the population of England has been, over this period, exposed to much higher concentrations of NOx. And that certainly has adverse health effects, which I won't go into in detail. This is a German study, 106 children in Freiburg, Germany. Their lung function being measured twice a day, children with asthmatic symptoms. And here's the NO2 per week. They were given one of these tubes to wear for a week, and then it was analyzed. And here is their lung function here measured. And you'll see, apart from a blip here, that when the NOx gets up in this region here, there's an obvious decrement of their lung function. So NOx will affect asthmatic children adversely, and there's a lot more European data. The Swiss have done a lot of work on NOx. There's not been much in North America. Well, NOx then, what about the air care goals? They were very nearly reached in 95 for NOx, a 3% reduction. We got a 2.7% reduction as a result of air care, and that roughly worked out at 460 tons a year. And this will be increased in the coming year. The NOx will be made more stringent, and more cars will be required to be re-examined in relation to NOx emission. This shows the present Canada standards for NOx emissions from cars here, and the California standard for light vehicles, which is half the Canadian here. And this is hydrocarbons in greens, very much less than the Canadian permitted maximum here. And the ultra low emission vehicle here, which is in production and in fact now available, and the zero emission vehicle here. And what's a zero emission vehicle? Well, a zero emission vehicle is a vehicle like an electric vehicle with no emission at all, and 2 to 10% of new car sales will be required to be zero emission between 1998 and 2003 in Los Angeles. Now, actually, one of the success stories in relation to redesign of engines is right here in North Vancouver, and that is the Ballard Research Project. I'd strongly recommend you to pay a visit there. They welcome people to go and look at what they're doing. They produced 18 months ago a bus driven by a hydrogen fuel cell. It was big, the fuel cell. It took the last two rows of seats, as well as the engine compartment, to accommodate it. They now have produced, for the first time, a bus with the engine, the hydrogen cell, only in the engine compartment. And they've got it about twice as efficient. The only pollutant this produces is water. And this is an effort that's been funded partly from Germany, but taken up in a big way by the city of Chicago. And 2 weeks ago, the mayor of Chicago was seen taking a glass and holding it to the tailpipe of a Ballard bus and drinking the water. This was to ram home the point that nothing else was there. The prospects of that company actually producing a module for a car are thought to be fairly good, but that's about 5 years away. And the bus issue, I think, may well eventually be solved by the hydrogen cell. And I hope when it is commercially available that BC Transit is made to invest in it. BC Transit has produced in the last 3 weeks a tremendous expansion program, an enormous capital investment, and I regret to say all of it in diesel buses. So that eventually the truth will dawn. Atlanta, which I showed you as the center of that ozone region, has ordered 1,000 natural gas-driven buses for the Summer Olympics. Now, a natural gas-driven bus isn't particularly good at NOx, but it's very good at particles, and it has virtually zero particle emission. So that 1,000 natural gas-driven buses will give a big impetus to that, and it's quite a good interim solution, not, I think, a final solution. What we have to do is to make sure that when these options become available, we make use of them. There are, within all governments, dinosaur departments of transport, highways, which can only think in terms of yesterday and the year before, which are not forward-looking. And the only way they can be made forward-looking is for the public to ask them questions. And when the public begins to say, why are we buying, for heaven's sake, another 60 diesel buses? What about the other options? You'll get some accountability into the system. If the California option of zero vehicles comes off, which I believe it will, it'll be mandated at the same time for Tokyo, which gives it a market of 32 million people. With that sort of market, it's very attractive to car makers. And the two car makers that have said they are ready for it are Honda, which took their Formula One racing team engineers off racing 8 years ago to develop a zero-emission vehicle, and are going to produce it later this year. And it's a combination of electric drive, battery, and a very small, highly efficient gasoline engine. It's a dual-powered effort. The other firm that is very optimistic about what it's doing is the Peugeot company in France, which has a revolutionary vehicle, not yet available for sale, but which is made of very lightweight materials, has practically no steel in it. It's all space-age plastics. It's about half the weight of a normal car. The battery, they say, will take it 300 miles at a charge. And what is even more important is that they say now there is a battery which can be recharged from flat in 6 minutes. This is really the key to this revolution that's coming, so that you could go to a downtown gas station, plug it into an electric meter, pay for the amount of electricity you've got, and you're charged up. There are solutions coming down the road, and we're not rich enough to pioneer them except for the Ballard cell, and we must make sure we take advantage of them. But I think and hope that my grandchildren will inherit cities which are virtually pollution-free. Thank you very much.
Tony, why don't you start?
You talked about the overall pollution, but what about the gradient effects? If you live right on a road, how much worse off are you, say, if you live on the east side of Granville Street or the west side of Granville Street or a block away? How much different are you getting from those local gradients? Because the stuff coming from the cars, the closer you are, the must be worse. But how much worse?
Quite a lot worse.
Would you mind repeating
the question? Yes, the question is, what about living close to highways and heavily traveled roads? Don't you get much more pollution? And the answer is yes, you do. There's a major study from Birmingham in England which showed that a very important risk factor for a child going to hospital with asthma was the distance the child lived from a major motorway. And that's probably a combination of the particulate pollution and the oxides of nitrogen. Nobody quite knows which. But I could show you the oxide of nitrogen gradient from a major highway, and it's a function of distance, as you'd expect. And you get very much less if you're 10 blocks away than if you're right on the road itself. So that what you say is absolutely right. Yes. Yes, why did the government back down on air care for the heavy trucks? Nobody has found a good way of measuring the particulate pollution from vehicles. In fact, at a talk I gave this morning to the Canadian Auto Workers Union, I was asked why the smoking car wasn't detected by air care. One of the characters there had an old car and it smoked, and he went through air care with no problem at all. The reason is that it's very expensive to measure it. And it's particularly difficult with diesels because the diesel particulate, if the diesel is a new engine, the production of particulates by a diesel is a direct function of engine temperature. So the first 10 miles of the day, you've got high particulate output. And when the engine is really warm, it may be quite low. And the question is to how you're going to design a fair test. I've recently spent 3 days at a symposium in Chicago on diesel vehicles, making me an instant expert. But I can tell you that I learned a great deal at it. For instance, we produced all sorts of tremendously good ideas. The research engineer for Cummins Diesel, which are the biggest makers of diesel engines in the world, gave a very good paper. And one of my friends put his hand up and said, why don't you take the exhaust from a diesel and put it back through the engine? Splendid idea, I would have thought. And he said, we tried that, but the particles wore the engine out in 2 months. I think that a heavy diesel inspection program will have to be introduced, but it is difficult to do, and it's certainly expensive. And Los Angeles has got to the point, we had a speaker here from Los Angeles 6 months ago, when they are now discussing with the trucking union banning all heavy diesel vehicles from Los Angeles, period. Well, that will take a lot of negotiation. They've got to the point in Los Angeles when they can't see any solution to this, and the idea of a particle trap and various things don't look like feasible options at the present time.
David, Harold. You haven't mentioned the question of public transport by train or by new vehicle electric car. Is this a factor? As it is in Europe, of course. Is there quite
a yes, the question is the public transport modes, the light rapid transport trains, electrically driven, and various other options of that sort, whether they have a great deal to contribute. I can refer you to the Vancouver study called 2021, which suggested that if we're going to go on growing the way we're growing, public transport will play a diminishing role in public transportation. Because people are living in Richmond and working in North Vancouver, and living in White Rock and working all over the place, and it's very hard to design a transit system. They aren't any longer in neat suburbs going into the center, which, of course, SkyTrain does fairly well. So, and they're going to expand SkyTrain, which will be a help. So that there are modes which you can help that way, but there are many others that you don't really affect. And the other thing to say about that is, I showed you London. That's got a well-developed underground system, buses everywhere, and they had this huge episode. So that even if you've got a well-developed public transit system, the automobile has to be controlled. And the British have learnt that to their cost. Yes. 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 The question really is whether the medical community is doing anything much useful in efforts to deal with pollution. I'd rather hoped you wouldn't have asked me that question. In fact, it's very hard to get the attention of any of the medical organizations. Canadian Medical Association, virtually uninterested. The same has been true in Britain, in which, although there have been overt health effects, the role of the British Medical Association has been marginal. Somehow they're so transfixed by economics at the present time that these longer-range concerns and so on seem to be more than they can stomach. I think the answer is there is a role for medical leadership, and there's been quite a lot in the United States, particularly the taking lead out of gasoline, in which the profession played a distinguished part. And that was a very important thing to do, I would say, in North America. The Europeans didn't think it was important at all. They thought this was American hysteria. But in fact, it was a very important public health step, and that was really moved along pretty well by members of the profession. Not the practicing profession, mostly the toxicologists, the people who were concerned about mental development of children. A lot of pediatricians were involved in getting lead out of gasoline because they are really people trying to protect the health of children. This is a huge problem, for instance, in Karachi, which has the highest lead in gasoline anywhere in the world. And the World Bank last year wrote that the levels of lead in the air of Karachi were so high that they were bringing up a generation of retarded children. Now, that's a little exaggeration, but their IQ is probably down 10 points by virtue of the lead which they're bound to inhale. And a friend of mine in Karachi has a conference starting next in about 2 weeks' time of medical people, including people from the States, to try and convince the government of Pakistan that it has to take lead out of Ghazni, which it hasn't so far been willing to do. So that in places, the medical profession has been helping. In Santiago, the medical profession has been doing a lot of getting something done about that level of pollution. And there are places where the medical profession has been active, not so much in Canada, I'm afraid, and they should be much more active. Yes. Yes, the two countries I know most about, there was, of course, a
question.
The question is companies having a daycare center in the company premises so that people can arrive there with a child and have it taken care of right there. The two countries that have really developed this are Denmark, which does have a national program of that sort, and France. And France, of course, has pioneered daycare, state daycare, across the whole country. It was the first Western country to do that. State-provided daycare centers, inspected, controlled, right across the whole of France. And they are located well from the point of view of industry. In other words, they're not actually in the industry in general, but they're very close to it. And they are state-planned, situated, staffed, inspected. And everyone I know in France with young children thinks this is just a tremendous system to have. It was briefly on the agenda of the Conservative Party of Canada, and it disappeared, as you recall, somewhere along the line. But you can do a lot of imaginative things there, and individual industries can certainly do a lot to provide the care right on the spot. And I think that's a very useful and important idea. It is difficult for a government to implement, but companies, by example, might well do more. Yes. The question is whether increasing air traffic contributes much to the pollution. I'm on very good ground here because Los Angeles International Airport, which is right in the center of Los Angeles, has been extensively studied from this point of view. And there are two things to say. Firstly, in the totality of Los Angeles, it contributes very little, like 3 to 4% of either particles or NOx, so that it doesn't add up to very much. However, it does if there is a long line of planes waiting to take off. And if you fly through O'Hare, you'll sometimes find yourself in a lineup of 15 to 20 aircraft with the engines going. Los Angeles reorganized its flight handling so that that would not happen at LAX, because that greatly puts up the pollution contribution. And it's very interesting that they have broadly succeeded. In fact, I was in a plane coming into Los Angeles, and we landed, and the gate wasn't ready, and we were put out on a sort of bit to one side, and the pilot said, "I'm going to be made to turn off the engines," which he did. And we sat there in dead silence. But that was because Los Angeles had introduced this and they were very concerned about it. I don't think here having an additional runway in Vancouver will make any difference to the problem, any significant difference.
to the problem. Right.
There are a lot more questions, and I would ask you if you could...
Yes, of course. The question is whether difference in school children's asthma between Squamish and Kitsilano being higher in Squamish might have anything to do with the pulp and paper mill there. This is a very difficult question to answer, which is one way of saying that I don't know. But the reason it's so difficult is that so many things seem to determine the prevalence of asthma in children. I'm part of a study of 3,600 children in 12 different communities in Los Angeles, and one of the things we're, of course, finding out about is asthma, and you've got a community where the asthma looks about double another community. And when you dissect it out, there are so many reasons. One is that there is, of course, a genetic predisposition to asthma, and this is strong in some ethnic groups, particularly in the States, in the Puerto Rican population. Puerto Rican children in the States have more than double the asthma prevalence of any other ethnic group. So that you can get variants because of that reason. It can be simply genetic, and you happen to have a sort of hot spot in Squamish. On the other hand, the effluents from pulp and paper mills are undoubtedly bad for asthmatic children. And the evidence from that is not Canadian, but Finnish. In Finland, they have a city, a small city really, rather like Prince George, with the Kraft pulp mills in a bowl of hills, about the same size as Prince George. They've done a lot of studies of that community versus another one 20 miles away without the facility. And the major difference is the level of illness in asthmatic children being so much greater in the community with the pulp and paper industry. Never been studied in Prince George. So that I think that there's quite a probability that asthma is aggravated by that environment in Squamish. I think that's, I could produce evidence that might convince a judge that that was likely. I think it's possible. But I think the actual, whether there's an actual disproportion in the genetic basis is something I can't answer. I don't know. That could also be a factor.
There are many of you wanting to ask questions, and I'm sure Dr. Bates would be pleased to answer questions afterwards, but in the interest of those who would like to leave, I would now like to call on Dean Martin Hollenberg from the Faculty of Medicine here at UBC to thank our speaker.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have been very fortunate this evening to have listened to one of the foremost experts in the world on air pollution, and David, with his usual clarity, has shown us the linkage between science and public health and the need for public policy. The importance of what he was talking about was brought home to me and some colleagues a few days ago when we visited one of the most polluted cities in the world, David, Bangkok, which must be right up there with Karachi. For those of you who have not been in Bangkok, it's a city of 6 million people. It's very flat, and it's crowded with automobiles and trucks and motorcycles, motorized bicycles, little transport, three-wheeled transports they call tuk-tuks, which wind in and out of the traffic. Every one of them, I expect, without any air pollution controls on them at all. I don't think it's a city that has ever heard of an air care program. To get from one place to another, if you're going by a car, you routinely give yourself at least an hour, even if it's just a block away. And we were in one taxi cab, and the driver had a television at the front of the cab for traffic jams. And the police who direct traffic, a lot of them wear masks, but we saw one policeman wearing his mask, and he had to blow his whistle every once in a while, so he very carefully cut a hole in his mask so he could put his whistle in. And I certainly hope, David, that Vancouver never gets to be like Bangkok or Karachi, but I think you brought home to us the importance of developing clean air vehicles and public policy so that in the future we will have a very, very clean Vancouver. And so, David, on behalf of everyone in the audience, we want to thank you for a very stimulating talk this evening. It's been terrific. It's taken all of our thoughts away from the Quebec referendum for a whole hour. And we really appreciate it, and certainly hope that you'll have every success in your efforts to improve public policy. And I think everybody here tonight will be with you in that crusade. Thank you.